All right. Study of the Bible. I don't know for sure because it's kind of hard to predict this sort of thing, but my guess is we'll probably have two or three more lessons and then be through with this series of lessons. I know somebody, I can't remember who it is, who marked it down when we started, so there are a few people shaking their heads, so you can let me know. I don't exactly know, but we've been on this for quite a long time and covered some very important things, and so now we're basically down, probably have two or three lessons left as we talk about the history of the English Bible. If you weren't here last week or the last couple of weeks, we've dealt thoroughly with William Tyndale, and remember, he's sort of the father of the English Bible, they like to say about him. But the most important thing, without going back over his whole life, is that in 1526, that's when he smuggled some Bibles back into England. And I have a few different sources, and it's kind of interesting how this works sometimes. Sometimes, this doesn't happen very often, but sometimes the sources that you have, the numbers, there's a pretty big gap between them. And so I don't know what that's about, and it's kind of hard to know. I have one source that said he smuggled 3,000 copies into England. I have another source that said he smuggled 6,000 copies. So quite a bit of difference there. But nevertheless, this is the first time the people in England now have access to the Word of God in their own language. They can pick it up and read it. And obviously, when it's all said and done, 3,000 copies isn't that many, but it's more than a few, and it's a beginning. And the ball is now rolling. And so that's a wonderful thing. Now, remember, it's just the New Testament that is a part of his Bible. And so that was in 1526. It wasn't until 1530 he started to work on the Hebrew, which tells you volumes about Tyndale and just his intelligence. We've already seen that he was fluent in eight languages, but the Hebrew was the language that probably he was least fluent in, and it appears by most sources that he pretty much taught himself Hebrew, and that is one of the most difficult languages to learn. Like we've seen just even over the course of this study, different things on the screen were a few Hebrew letters and words are up there and you look at them and they're just hard. You know, they don't have a vowel system and just little dots and symbols and things. Not to mention the fact that they write backwards to us, you know, and so they're going from right to left instead of the other way around. And so to teach yourself that, and to the point where you can now, in a very competent way and scholarly way, translate that to English is pretty impressive. He did that. He started in 1530. Remember, he did the Pentateuch in 1531. It's when he did the book of Jonah. And then in 34, he revised Genesis. And in 35 is when he did two more New Testaments. He revised it two more times. But when you think about the books that were smuggled into England, they were the New Testament books that he had. And so we went over just quickly. I'll just not go over it in great detail. This is just sort of interesting to me. The charges that were brought against him, he was ultimately put to death for his belief and stance that every individual should have the Bible, and of course for some of the doctoral positions that he took. And that's just interesting to me because some of those things he died for really weren't scriptural. I remember, he's a reformer, and the reformers really needed reforming when it's all said and done. So because most people who came out of the Reformation movement believed in faith only, very strongly, and he certainly was one of them. So, but a lot of things that you see on the screen there are things that we would that we would oppose. Now, number one, of course, we would oppose him on that. Number four, he denied the free will. He was wrong in that. But a lot of these things, he denied purgatory. That got him into trouble with the Catholic Church and so on. So, but those were the charges brought against him. And when it's all said and done, none of that really should be worthy of death. But there you have it. He was put to death and in 1536. And then just quickly, if you weren't here last week, it is interesting as well that these are some of the terms that he coined, words and phrases that he coined that we now have. And even if you no longer use the King James Version, like many of you don't, these are words and phrases we're all familiar with, aren't they? And he coined them. If it wasn't for Tyndale, we wouldn't have that. Remember, we're talking about translations from the original to English. And so all of those things could have been translated in different ways. But he just had a way with words. He was a great linguist, and he just knew how to put things. And so, you know, these are things that kind of stuck with us over the years. Even I no longer use the King James, but still these are very familiar terms. So just interesting. That's just a handful of them. They're literally, I could put that on the screen probably 10 times over with different words and phrases that he coined that we have because of the way he translated those things. So sort of interesting with regard to that. All right, so that is William Tyndale, and he got the ball rolling. But now we move on to Miles Coverdale. And he was an associate of Tyndale, and depending on, again, your source, some make a stronger connection between him and William Tyndale. Some think that he was the proofreader of some of the translations that Tyndale did. And I have at least two sources that claim that. But let me look with you, if I can always forget which one is the thing. Someone was asking about, you know, these lines and what they represent with that, with all of this. Now, we're working our way up, of course, to all of these modern translations that we have today that many of us use. Of course, I use the ESV but all of these are kind of in a group together because they come from the same source. And so we'll talk about that maybe more. But we're way down here. We saw Wycliffe. He got the ball rolling. But remember, he was the first one to come up with an English Bible. But his translation was from the Vulgate. And that's what these little lines represent. You see, right here is where it came from, the Vulgate. And then down here, he used for his Old Testament the Masoretic text that we spent so much time dealing with. See? And so, well, there's a few things to remember. Then here comes Tyndale that we just finished talking with. And this has 1525. Again, we'll not get bogged down with exact time. I think it should say 1526, but it says 25 on this particular screen. So, but his source, you remember, don't want to hit the wrong button again here, but he wanted to do something that Wycliffe didn't do. He wanted to go back to the original language. And so we talked about that. So you have lines going down here to ancient copies, because that represents the manuscripts that he used. But remember, it was Erasmus who put forth the first critical Greek text. And remember what we said about him? Anybody remember how many manuscripts did he have to work with? Huh? Seven. That's right. Seven. And seven kind of late manuscripts. There, five of them were 12th century, and two of them were even 15th century, but that's all he had to work with. And Tyndale, then, his translation was based on his work, on Erasmus's work. See, so, but they were ancient manuscripts. They were the original language. They were Greek, and so he used that for his New Testament and some of the Vulgate there. Well, then now we come to Coverdale. Let me go back. I knew I'd do that. Hit that crazy thing. I need a separate clicker, huh? But here's now we're to Coverdale, and he again was simply an associate of Tyndale. He was educated at Cambridge like Tyndale was. He was born in Yorkshire, the same place as Wycliffe was born. But he came along and about 1526. We find him, he was a priest in a little place called Norwich, a part of a little town in England. I think in 1514, we know that he was a priest there. But you fast forward to 1526, and he was an individual who was one of the individuals who was defending a man by the name of Robert Barnes. And Robert Barnes was an English Lutheran. Now, who can tell me, you may know, where are most of the Lutherans from? Germany, right. They're almost all German. But he was an English Lutheran. But he was on trial because he was being accused of heresy. He preached a sermon on Christmas Eve of 1525 where he really exposed the ecclesiastic abuses that were going on, some of the clerical pomp that he was all against, preached against that. So he basically was being tried for heresy. And Coverdale was one of the people who were defending him, a part of his defense. And the only reason why any of that is important is because that puts Coverdale in kind of dangerous ground. Remember, at this time in England, everybody's very hostile. All the Catholics, very hostile towards Protestantism and anything associated with having the Word of God in English. That was a capital offense. And so Coverdale's there. He's defending him, and now he's kind of, associated with him. And he begins to realize that England is not very safe. So he flees to Antwerp, which is the very place where Tyndale was betrayed by Henry Phillips, remember, and ultimately arrested. And so that's where he is, and that's probably where he develops this association with Tyndale. And again, as some people think, perhaps even becomes one of his proof readers. But he has the distinction of producing the first complete English Bible. And now Tyndale's awaiting execution in a dungeon cell now. And during that time, even before Tyndale was put to death in 36, he completes an English Bible, but it's complete. Remember, Tyndale's was just the New Testament. And Coverdale's was, as we see over there on the screen again, that his was complete. And so that's a pretty good distinction for him to have. He's down in history as the man who produced the first complete Bible. That's what it looks like. You can actually go online and copy the whole thing if you wanted to, the Coverdale Bible. And it's just wonderful technology that we have now, but that's the original first edition of the Coverdale Bible. And it's the first complete Bible in English that ever came about. And so pretty neat stuff, really, when you stop and think of it. He used Tyndale's New Testament. Then for the Old Testament, he used a couple of different Luther's German translation. He used Ulrich Zwingli's Zurich Bible. He used, and then, of course, the Latin Vulgate he used. So he used different things for his Old Testament, but his New Testament would have been Tyndale's. And then the Pentateuch would have been tendils, and Jonah would have been tendils, and so, but the rest, of course, he had to do the rest himself, because Tyndale was arrested before he could complete it. And so it would be based on those translations. But in the end, it was a complete English Bible. So you make a mental note of that, 1535, that's where we head. Now you just think about, it hadn't been all that long. Remember, it was in the 14th century, where there wasn't anything in all of England, all of the area. There wasn't any English Bible at all. Everybody had to rely on the priest for everything. And so now here we fast forward to 1535, and we have a complete English Bible. And so that's wonderful. Well, then this fella came along. John Rogers is really his name, but he wrote under the pen name Thomas Matthew. And he was a close friend of Tyndale's as well. And the reason, of course, anyway, you tell me, why do you think he had a pen name? Huh? Exactly right. To protect himself. So, I mean, he knew he was working in England. And, a lot of people would flee to Europe and do because they were forced to, but he was working in England. So he used that name so people would know who he was. But we know that John Rogers was a good friend of Tyndale. He eventually was put to death. He's another one that gave his life. And the list is huge, is long, of people who died so that we could have the English Bible. And he ultimately, I think it was in 1540, if I remember right, that he was put to death. I believe that he was the first martyr. Maybe it was a little bit after that he was put to death, but he was the first one put to death by Queen Mary the First. Anybody tell me, you history buffs, what her nickname was? Bloody Mary. That's right. And we'll see. She persecuted a lot of the Protestants. Hundreds of them she had put to death in her short reign as queen. And we'll see that. But he produced what is called Matthew's Bible. Sometimes it's just called the Matthew Bible, sometimes Matthew's Bible. But it was published in 1537. And so that was, again, just another step along the way. And let's see over here. You can see the lines here. Goes, that's him in 1537. I know some of that's hard to read. It's hard for me to read right here. But he used Covendale. Of course, that would be Tyndale's translation. And then on the side here, you see it goes right on down to the Vulgate there. So those lines are just telling you the source of where these things came from. His was a combination of, he used Tyndale's and then he used Covendale's. He, they would always use, Tyndale was so respected and his translation was so good, everybody used it where they could. But since he didn't complete it, you had to go to some other sources. And so that was Matthew's Bible. And you see, we're just working our way up to the King James, in which, most people think about with regard to translations. And that's not too far off there. We're now down to 1537. And then we come to what is called the Great Bible. And the Great Bible was great. Why do you think it was called the Great Bible? Huh? Because it was big. That's not what I would think of at first. But that's the only reason why it was called the Great Bible. It was huge. And it was a lot bigger than all the other Bibles that were produced. But it really, truly is great for more than that reason. That is why it was called the Great Bible. But it was a great Bible because it was the first Bible that was authorized. And in other words, go back a little before we get to that. In other words, this was the first Bible, and sometimes it's called the chain Bible because it, you see that little chain hanging there? It was, again, Henry VIII authorized it to be read in all of the churches. Now see, remember, up until this time, this is outlawed. English Bibles, it's a capital offense. But now when we get down to the Great Bible, it's actually the first authorized version. And so... Yeah, it was quite a bit, but basically, yeah. Yes, 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 yes. All of these were done off of a printing press. So it's been almost 100 years since that has happened, but the general time. But yeah, but these are all printed copies. So yes, but you think to yourself, well, how in the world, how did we get here so quickly? Like just. And in fact, there are some people who are still being persecuted. Like Tyndale died in 1536. So this, you remember, anybody remember? I just maybe said it in passing. When he was on that stake and he had that rope around him and about to be lit on fire, of course, they strangled him to death first. What did he, the best he could, probably was not much more than a whisper, but what did he say, his last words? Anybody remember? He wanted someone's eyes to be opened. He prayed, Lord, open the King of England's eyes. And that would have been Henry VIII. And so that was in 1536. Now 3 years later, we have Henry VIII authorizing the English Bible. Remember, he's a strong enemy of it up to this point. Now he's authorizing the English Bible to be found in every local church and to be read in the worship services. And so that's quite, that is a huge step forward in the history of the English Bible. That now it is authorized. And the way all, now, I like to say, I like to make it real dramatic and stand before you and say, that's because God, he answers prayer. And there's Tyndale. And a lot of Protestants and a lot of things you read will say that. But I don't think it has much to do with that at all. I think it has to do with, really, a great step forward in the English Bible came about because this King Henry was a terrible husband. and he was just generally a bad man in some ways. Now, it all just depends on how you want to look at history. He really, most scholars would tell you, is responsible for the English Reformation, which is, that's a step forward. And a lot of people in the religious world think that's a great thing. And so you give him credit for that. But really, his big problem was he was a bad husband. He was a womanizer. He was born in 1491. Now, he married Catherine of Aragon in 1509. That's the same year he became king. His father was Henry VII. And when his father died, then, of course, he ascended to the throne. But now this Catherine was first married to his brother Arthur. And she, at that time, he was the Prince of Wales, so she was the Princess of Wales. But after they were married, just for 20 weeks, he died. And so Henry VII, the father, really encouraged them and offered him to Catherine, her father. She was from royalty in France, and he wanted the two families to be close because politically all that was important. And so he offered King Henry VIII to marry Catherine. But he was just 17 years old. His brother Arthur, when he died, was just 15 years old. So, I mean, you know, things happen at a very young age in those days. But that happened. And they married. And there were some things that had to be worked out, dowry that had to be paid to her family and things that they wrestled with for several months. But finally, they married. And from all accounts, in the beginning, most people said that in those day, for those days, they had a pretty decent marriage. But now, one issue that arose is that Catherine couldn't produce a son for him. And which was very important. They had I can't remember now how many children they had, but the only surviving child that they had was a child by the name of Mary. Guess who she grew up to be? What was her nickname? Bloody Mary. But now that was the only child that survived between Henry VIII and Catherine. And so he got frustrated because she couldn't provide for him a son that could take his place, be his heir apparent. And so it looked like she would be, but that was, you know, there was no precedent for that at all. And he didn't like that at all. And so he started to take it out on her. Plus he was a womanizer. So he had, most accounts would tell you that he had a lot of affairs. He was unfaithful to her over and over again. And now there's only maybe two or three verifiable, you know, where we know. I mean, we know for a fact he was unfaithful to his wife. He has children from other women, so he was unfaithful to his wife. One of his affairs led to a son who was an illegitimate son, and there'll be more about him in just a minute. Henry Fitzroy, I think, was his name. But anyway, he at 1527, he's having all these affairs and things. He really becomes infatuated with a woman by the name of Annie Boleyn. And first of all, he had an ongoing affair, and most people think he had two children by Annie's sister, Mary. So he's in a relationship with Mary, but he becomes infatuated with Annie. But she won't be seduced by him. She doesn't want to get involved with him at first. But now he's just obsessed. He becomes obsessed with her. And as time goes on, he still doesn't have any sons. So he decides, there's a couple of things I can do in this situation. I need to have a son. So how am I going to do that? I can legitimize Henry Fitzroy, you'd have to go through the Pope to do that, and, you know, think that it would be challenged and all of that. So he didn't know if he could do that or not, but that would be one of his options. Or he could try to just, you know, get rid of Catherine. Just, you know, send her on her way. And the second thing he could do is try to marry off Mary. And, you know, but I mean, that's a long shot. You know, not that. I mean, only because by the time, in other words, he'd marry her off and then she'd have a son. And that son could become heir to his throne. But chances are he'd be dead and gone by that time. So that one option. But his third option was to get rid of Catherine and then find a woman who was at childbearing age. And preferably that would be Annie. Guess what option he chose? He chose Annie. He said, all right, then you got to go through the Pope still. So Clement VII is the Pope, and he said, well, he goes to the Pope, and he asks for an annulment. And his big plan was, there's a passage I may get it wrong, Leviticus chapter 21. We're not trying to search for it a long time, but I think it's Leviticus 21. Let's see, where He uses a verse to justify his situation. I'm trying to see. Anyway, there is a passage that talks about that you cannot marry your brother's widow. And he no doubt takes it out of context. It's chapter 20, Leviticus chapter 20 at verse 21. If a man takes his brother's wife, it is impurity. He has uncovered his brother's nakedness. They shall be childless. Now, he takes that out of context, you know, but he's going to go before the Pope and say, see this? The Pope before you had no right to authorize this marriage in the first place. Now you need to annul it. And that's his big plan. And then once he gets annulled from Catherine, he's going to marry Annie. See? Well, guess what the Pope says? He wouldn't allow it. No way. And there's a lot. I mean, that's making a long story short. There's a lot that went into it. But basically, when it's all said and done, the Pope said no. And he said, oh, yes, I'm going to do this anyway. And he banished Catherine, gave her rooms to Annie. And I think that was 1531 or so. And in 32, he arranged to have a certain man to be Archbishop of Canterbury, who had the authority to annul things and things, and had him to annul his marriage to Catherine in 1532. And so he got what he wanted, but the Pope excommunicated him. So at that point then, when that happened, he initiated what's called the Act of Supremacy in 1534. In other words, he as king, that was a law that was set forth to declare that the King of England would be the head of the Church of England. And so basically the Church of England started in 1534. And now, you know, he's breaking from the Catholic Church. Up to this point, all records indicate that he was a pretty faithful Catholic. The Pope wouldn't give him what he wanted. So he rebelled and broke off and started the Church of England. Say, now, it's that with all that background, eventually, and it, you know, it takes a couple of years now. That's in 1539, but the Great Bible, remember, it came along in 1539. So things are being worked out, and finally it got to the point where now he's no longer, the king's no longer Catholic. Now he wants the Bible read in English in all of these churches. And that opened the way, because he was a terrible husband, that opened the way for the English Bible to have free course and to be authorized in England now. And so by the time we get to it, then you find that the English Bible is now no longer outlawed. It's no longer capital punishment to have it. And so it came about in kind of a bad way how that happened. You know, again, I like to say it was because Tyndale prayed, but that wasn't it. And, you know, Tyndale, again, he was a reformed and he had a lot of issues himself. Well, that's a different discussion for a different time of whether or not he even had a praying relationship with God. He was a reformist, what he was. See, so I wouldn't take the position at all that God answered his prayers or do. No, this wasn't theology, really. It was a king who wanted what he wanted and rebelled against the Pope so he could get what he wanted. And as a result, the Church of England came about and the English Bible started to have free course. All right, then you get up, and we're running out of time here, but see how far we're going here? We're making progress here. Now you're all the way up to the Geneva Bible, 1560. And the reason it's called Geneva Bible is because that's the place it was published and printed, in Geneva. And the way that came about was that Henry VIII died. And who do you think ascended to the throne? His daughter. That's exactly right. He didn't have any sons. And so this one daughter that survived from Catherine, Mary, became the queen. And she had one goal in mind. She wanted to accomplish one thing, and that was to bring England back to the Catholic Church and under the authority of the Pope. And so in her short period of time that she was queen, she started just a severe persecution, killing Protestants left and right, and everybody had to flee. People like Miles Covendale and John Knox and others had to flee to Geneva to get away from her wrath. And so she has the title Bloody Mary because of that. But it was at Geneva then, 2 years after she died, that the Geneva Bible came about. And so we'll talk more about that. Is that the first bell? Okay. All right.